the responsibility of building inspectors and so forth. I argue that it should be child-centered rather than perpetrator-centered, because if misfortune befalls the kid, it doesn't matter who's responsible. We want to understand conditions of neglect, for example. Okay, where do we get definitions? Well, we started out getting them from public opinion. There's a very nice book. It's a little old, but it really lays out. It's by Barbara Nelson. It was published, I think, in 84 on making an issue of child abuse, and it details going back into the 19th century and the evolution of public policy in terms of child care considerations. She details that history very nicely. Then there's another book that's also University of Chicago Press by Joel Best called Threatened Children, and points out the misinformation that drives public opinion. And one of my favorite ones is, I won't ask you guys to raise your hands, but as to whether or not you believe it or not, but it's widely believed that children are at risk for harm at Halloween. You can take your kid's candy to an ER and get it x-rayed to see if somebody adulterated the candy by putting razor blades and needles in it. You know, this is and Newsweek and other various public media outlets have talked about the dangers at Halloween, and then whether or not candy might be adulterated with, say, cyanide, for example. And then they tell you never to take, or your child shouldn't have cookies baked by that lady down the street, or popcorn balls, or all the other kinds of things. Well, it turns out there's absolutely zero. There has never been a child harmed because of adulterated candy from trick-or-treat. Never in the entire history of this urban myth. But we have public policy driven. We have communities that won't let, they constrain trick-or-treating. They issue all these warnings. Now, kids get hit by cars running across the street at Halloween. They're wearing a mask and they don't see, or they're all excited, or they do something. But there was a kid who died of a heroin overdose. That shows up in the press, but he got into his uncle's stash. And didn't get it. They tried to blame it on some boogeyman out there. There was a kid who died of cyanide poisoning. It's also reported. His father did. It was a copycat from the old cyanide Tylenol scare. That's why we can't open our bottles, you know. So anyway, so public opinion drives things and drives force. The other thing is stranger danger. The news always has stranger danger, how you protect your kids. I always tell my classes, get the kids out on the street where they're safe. Because maltreatment is primarily in the home. I think it's tomorrow, I talk about risk factors and epidemiology. So anyway, we've got a whole lot of public opinion worried about threatened children because of these terrible, and there are occasional stranger abductions, but they're extraordinarily rare. Extraordinarily rare. They're tragedies when they happen, but in the big picture of maltreatment, they don't account for any significant variance. And then we have federal and state statutes, we have federal regulations, we have clinical practice differences, we have public policy, which comes out of public opinion, and then research. So anyway, I'm just giving you an example of how many federal statutes there are that relate to child abuse and neglect and have implications for defining it. This was the seminal work, the Mondale Act, because Fritz Mondale really pushed it back in 1974, the original Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, which mandated states to develop reporting procedures, and it was really an important act. I always like to call attention to this, because the Indian Child Welfare Act, 78, Public Law 95608, requires that an out-of-home placement for children who are maltreated, who happen to be Native Americans, that you have to apply a standard of clear and convincing evidence as opposed to preponderance of evidence, which applies to other children. And that was motivated by the fact that there were so many Native American children who were in out-of-home placements. But one of the interesting things about it is, are we protecting children, or are we protecting tribal entities? So one of the challenges is how does one respond in a culturally sensitive fashion versus how does one meet the needs of children? So when I've been involved in cases involving tribal members, you have a tribal attorney, you have a tribal social worker, you have a state social worker, you have a county attorney, you have a guardian ad litem, you have all these people. I mean, it's a real interesting mix. So anyway, there's lots of federal statutes. There's also a whole lot of federal policies. NIMH and NICHD will not fund research with children if the investigators don't embrace notions of investigating and reporting child maltreatment. Human subject guidelines for research institutions are grappling with how to fund, and especially since I do research on abuse and neglect, I'm always in meetings with institutional review boards. And then I have a certificate of confidentiality, which is from the federal government, which supersedes state law. So I'm actually not obligated under state law to report child maltreatment, but I'm obligated by my funding agency. So I moved from being a mandatory reporter to being a permissive reporter, because I'm permissive with respect to state law, but it's all very complicated. But this is an example of a federal policy and regulation that controls my behavior. Anyway, most state statutes, the goal of child maltreatment legislation is to protect children, and I italicize that because a lot of people think that it's designed for prosecutorial vigor or to prosecute people who engage in maltreatment of children. But in fact, it's really the motivation behind these statutes and really the implications of these statutes is primarily to protect children. And most states define maltreatment, and they distinguish among physical abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, and all states have some consideration of psychological or emotional abuse as well. I'm just going to skip all these things because they don't really relate to defining, but unless if something seizes your attention, just stop me. Anyway, what are the problems with state definitions? I mean, where are you from?
Colorado.
Colorado.
To Colorado. Well, the Kempe Center's played a big role where are you from?
Washington.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I don't have any exemplars of statutes from your states, but
Colorado has a very, I don't know what field you're in, but I am actually in social work. And there's very stringent child protective services is very their mode of operation is to keep the children at home as long as possible.
Oh, that's different though. That's what you do. See, that's one of those very interesting things as to whether the state public policy when maltreatment occurs, whether you are obligated to engage in Herculean efforts to protect preserve family structure versus states that are, and almost all states say that they're working hard to keep families together. Almost all states say that, but they play it out in different ways. I've got a lot of experience I've got a lot of familiarity with Oregon because I collaborate with research in Oregon, and then Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin and Nebraska are the states that I have the greatest direct experience with. Sometimes that's a really bad idea. Sometimes there's nothing better for a kid than terminating parental rights, and it's good to get it done early. And I was involved in a case where it took 8 years to do a termination of parental rights. We don't want to go there, but I mean, 8 years is a long time for a child to be in foster care. So she was 16 when the termination of parental rights. I make the hair on your back if you knew about her life experiences. You'd say, whoa, how could that happen? Anyway, so states are pretty vague as to how they define abuse. They're almost all vague. There are people who say that's a virtue, and other people say it's a liability. And they're just hammer and tong with each other as to whether or not we should enhance the specificity or whether we should reduce it. Most states have distinctions or have some aspects of abuse and neglect that are embedded in criminal codes, that's primarily in the context of sexual abuse. So most abuse statutes are civil codes and civil procedures, but there are some criminal considerations. And then some states have different standards for what constitutes evidence of maltreatment. And that moves over time, so things have changed. And then this whole question about harm versus endangerment. So you could call, when I call, my RAs tell me to call because they think that we should report something sometimes, and then I'll call the county and I'll say, you know, hi Connie, this is John. We got a subject that, and this is what's going on. And she'll say, oh John, you know better than to call me about that one, you know. Can you see the bruising? Can you see the hemorrhages? You know? So anyway, this endangerment, with some exceptions these days, is getting to be harder because we've got huge budget shortfalls, as you know, in Colorado and every state. So we're asking people to do more and more with less and less. So. Well, anyway, this is a really good resource for if you're interested in that. I can send it to you. So let's do the easy one first, that's sexual abuse, because that's the simplest. And it's not simple, but it's simplest in terms of defining. In most cases, sexual abuse is clearly delineated in the state statutes. There's no relational perpetrator limitation, so you don't have to worry about whether you're dealing with intrafamilial or extrafamilial. Engaging in erotic acts, specific sexually abusive acts with children, constitutes, in most states, it's either going to be a felony or a misdemeanor in the criminal code, and it constitutes abuse in the civil code. There's usually some consideration of the circumstances, and this has to do with coercion. So sexual abuse in the third degree is different than sexual abuse in the second degree, and it might have some implications for it. And of course, there's differences in different states, but mostly we're interested in detailing whether there's any elements of coercion. And then in most states, there's some consideration of an age differential between the perpetrator and the victim, and the question of informed consent. Now, the presumption is that children can't engage in informed consent to engage in sexual activity, and there's a presumption that if there's an age differential beyond a certain level, given the developmental status of the child, that would violate informed consent. So for example, in some jurisdictions, if you're a 14-year-old girl and you engage in sexual activity with somebody who, say, is 18 years old, that's a 4-year age differential, and if it's a state that has a 5-year age differential, then that wouldn't constitute sexual abuse. So it would be a consenting activity. If a 3-year-old child is engaging in sexual activity with, say, a 4-year-old kid down the block, a 7-year-old child, so you've got a 4-year age differential, there would be a presumption of an element of coercion there in an absence of informed consent. So the age differential, and again, this is highly variable among states. So some states have a 3-year age differential for young children, a 5-year age differential for older children. Some states use a 5-year age differential. If there's an element of coercion, the age differential doesn't apply. So that if you're a 19-year-old and you're engaging in coercive sexual activity with a minor, coercion doesn't have to be threats of physical coercion. It can also be other kinds of threats. So anyway, and this is just to give you an idea of how many chapters in the Iowa Criminal Code, just picking Iowa as an example, but all the states are the same. It just details all these different acts, and these are all statutes related to these are criminal code sexual statutes pertaining to children. And that example I used before, see, you charge a guy with indecent contact with a child 709.12, but he really should have been charged with 709.8, lascivious acts on the child. And these are typically ranked order in terms of severity of the act. So, anyway. So what are the recommendations that come out of the interagency task force? One of them is an unambiguous detailing of act and perpetrator specification. If we're going to talk about sexual abuse, then we ought to really specify what were the acts that occurred. So in both research and clinical practice, we shouldn't just say sexual abuse occurred. We should indicate whether it was a penetrating insult, the circumstances under which it occurred. Now, we really need detailed specification. We should have some index of duration and frequency, because we really don't know about the consequences of maltreatment, because we've thrown long-term and short-term, single episode versus long-term exposure. I evaluated a kid one time who was 16 who had 8 years of sexual exploitation by her mother's boyfriend that was unidentified until she was 16. I mean, that's a really different set of circumstances than somebody who might have had a single event. We shouldn't use adverse outcome criteria in defining it. And by this I mean, one of the things that happens, this is particularly the case with prosecutors, they want psychologists like me to establish that the child had some adverse psychological sequelae as a means of documenting that this alleged event occurred. Now, what you've got there is you've got two problems. You've got the consequence defining an independent event. You can't do that. You know, scientifically, it makes no sense. But so there was a case in Iowa City where the prosecution wanted to establish that these children had adverse psychological effects. It was a kind of a weird case where this guy who was a teaching assistant, who had a lot of priors, he shouldn't have been in the schools. But he's married to a teacher. It was all very complicated. And it was an interesting prosecution. And they were prosecuting the principal for aiding and abetting, and anyway, it's just a mess. But one of the things was is that the question is, were these allegations, and he was photographing children, and they were kind of soft porn, crotch shots, things like that, but the kids were clothed, so it was relatively in the big range of things that occur, you know, it was relatively minor sexual abuse. But nevertheless, it occurred in the school, and it was not appropriate. But anyway, what they wanted to do was to establish the veridicality of these allegations. They wanted the kids to have psychological problems, which is an unfair burden. So you put a burden on the victim to present with psychopathology, they shouldn't have to do that. You just should be able to establish that these things occurred appropriately. Anyway, so I'm really concerned about that, but this happens. Let's talk about physical abuse. Most of the time, people talk about acts of commission, as that you actually did something to a child. And some people talk about acts plus consequences, so that you might strike a child, but it's only abuse if it's associated with some proximal consequences of tissue damage. And the question is, what level of tissue damage? Is it harmful? So Michael Wald in the Stanford Law Review argues that it should involve hard tissue damage. So bruising wouldn't count in Michael Wald's model. He wants fractures. He's an attorney, he's got a kind of a narrow constrained view of Hollywood, but it relates to his view of jurisprudence. So he wants substantial harm, so you're talking about consequences here, and here we're typically talking about physically injurious consequences as opposed to psychological sequelae. Then, as I suggested, Michael Wall figures that you really need to have a relatively high standard of tissue damage. These days, in physical abuse, with some exceptions, mostly you need some sort of tissue damaging standard. Blows being struck would typically not be sufficient unless there's a clear and present danger. Now here's an important point, and that is the question of intentionality. Some states and some jurisdictions and some investigators think that we should distinguish abuse as a function of the intentions of the perpetrator, that is, an intention to harm versus an intention to help. Well, I can't tell you how many hundreds of physically abusive people I've interviewed over the year. I've never talked to anybody who said they intended to harm that kid. They wanted to do better in school. They wanted to affect social behavior. They wanted to knock off those irritating responses. But they never say, I really wanted to stick it to that little guy. So my argument is intentionality can't be assessed unequivocally. People are always giving you socially desirable reasons for why they do things. So I've argued, and I don't think I'm winning this argument, by the way. I've got a lot of papers out there arguing we should not define maltreatment as a function of the putative intentions.
Are you talking more about motive than intent? The person intended to hit the child, whether he was supposed to.
Well, motive would be the same sort of thing. There are some instances of frankly homicidal acts. There are some instances. You can always come up with examples, and they're so relatively rare that you can remember them. You know, the blocking on her name, the woman who drowned her kid by running the car into the lake in South Carolina. My kid got a lot of mileage out of that because when everybody was running around looking for this alleged black guy who abducted, remember the story? My son, who of course had the misfortune of growing up with me, he was a student at Michigan at the time. And he wrote a paper saying, you know, it's got to be the mother. And long before it ever was the mother, but he'd been listening to me, and you go with base rates. It's just improbable. You don't stop out in the middle of the country. The whole description was goofy. And then the woman who drowned her kids in Texas is another example. I evaluated a woman who tried to kill her kids. She did kill. She was really, she was stabbed. And she was in the process of stabbing her kids, and one of them ran outside. It was amazing that she ran outside, and somebody intervened on her behalf, otherwise she would have been successful. But those are very rare.
Yeah. The question I would have was, you mentioned on the couple slides back was the different laws. Do you think the laws have improved and changed toward the better, or just understanding it more? Understanding it more?
I don't know. I think you really should get an attorney to talk about that one. But I think some state statutes have improved. I think they have. I think in a lot of ways the state statutes
overall, I
think we've got a better statutory base. But I'll show you some examples where you say, well, how can this be? But the base rate, if you're looking at fatalities, and fatalities are nice for data because you hardly ever have unreported deaths. You see? So fatalities give us real stable information in a way, and those numbers don't seem to change much. And we typically distinguish between a non-accidental injurious death versus a frankly homicidal act and where people actually try to kill the kid. And those tend to be relatively rare. Wilson and Daly have reviewed all, they have built some extensions of social biology to humans looking at filicidal and uroxicidal behavior. And where the guy kills his wife or girlfriend and then kills the kids. Those are relatively rare. It took Wilson and Daly had to look at all these court records from all over North America. They're Canadian investigators, but they use US and Canadian data. But the base rates of those are relatively rare. They're tragic, but they're so infrequent as to not be a useful way to think about the broader range of bad things that happen to kids. Yeah.
This is only about less than a month ago, I think it is now, but within the greater Seattle area, somebody had stabbed the whole family and then set the whole house on fire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And try to cover it up.
Oh, sure. Oh. Those things, I'm not denying that they happen. It just, and the problem is, when they do happen, they galvanize the public's attention. And you think about, what can we do to prevent that? As opposed to all those kids in Seattle that are being harmed because of much more mundane, equal harm. You know, I mean, the costs and the consequences are severe. I mean, as a social worker in Colorado, I mean, you see those things day after day after day, that kind of insidious erosion of the child's opportunities and the degree of harm that befalls those kids. And we pay very little attention to it because we become galvanized by these really spectacular and very interesting cases. But the rates are pretty low. And then there's this issue of contemporary social norms. And this is one of the things that's always a particular problem for me. And that is, I've had attorneys who have argued that the discipline used by these families who live in some mobile home court is somehow socially acceptable. Well, when people have actually done research looking for subcultural differences in norms, there are precious few differences that actually are things. So people like to assert that there are subcultural differences. And I have this kind of difference of opinion with Ken Dodge and some others who have argued that severe physical discipline is more acceptable in black communities, and that the adverse consequences are less severe. Well, and I've actually had black mothers tell me, well, you just have to beat a kid's ass. He's a black kid. He's not like a white kid. You can't. Well, so I say, wait a minute here. You know, it's bad enough that the society is discriminating against your kid. Why are you doing it too? You know, what? Why is that more sensitive? See, why is that better for that child? To have, there's a woman who's always raising questions. Well, Diana English, who's from Seattle, she and I often have a disagreement because she wants to, this has to do with neglect, which I'll get to in a second. I hope I get to it in a second. Anyway, she always argues that we should cut migrant workers some slack. And I said, wait a minute, why is it okay for a migrant worker to fall on a grain auger? But it's not okay for the owner of the farm's kid to fall in a grain auger. You know, so that this is on the issue of supervision. See, so who's being protected when we try to mount some sort of consideration of subcultural differences? When people have actually studied subcultural differences, precious few differences emerge, and they're always really subtle little things. And then, well, you can't be physically abusive to the neighbor's kid. It's assault. But if you're charged with the care of the child, babysitters, they can be physically abusive. And then there's some age limitations. So certain acts can be done with older kids but can't be done with younger kids. And then there's contextual factors. So if you hit a kid with a ball bat because he wanders into the path of somebody who's swinging a bat in a softball game, is different than, you know, you can have circumstances. Teaching a child wrestling moves in the living room where they hit their head on the table, you know, that's a bad idea. You shouldn't be teaching wrestling moves in the living room. But you know, there are accidents that happen. And then the other one is, one of my favorite ones is when people come in and say, well, the kid got hurt, but it was something, and they got this injury because of the high chair or something. Turns out there's a huge literature out there on consumer product safety. So when somebody gives you an improbable description of how something happened, you know, like falling downstairs, all these kinds of things, there's that literature out there. You know what the typical injury are. You know the locus of those injuries. You know. Anyway. So maybe. Oh, this is one of the things I wanted to point out. The role of corporal punishment. Here's three state statutes. Some states explicitly exclude corporal punishment from abuse. reasonable manner, moderate degree, South Carolina. Some states include corporal punishment that is cruel, prolonged, or circumstantially excessive. Now, try and operationalize that. And then there's some states that say nothing about corporal punishment, like Iowa. There's nothing in the statute about corporal punishment. What about corporal punishment in schools? That was a 1980 thing, Department of Education. That had relevance to these two Supreme Court decisions. It's very interesting that if you can look at a map of the U.S. and the probability of corporal punishment in the schools goes up as you move from the north to the south. So the southeast is where it's most common. In Ingraham v. Wright, which was a Supreme Court decision that upheld corporal punishment in the schools, Thurgood Marshall's dissenting opinion said that decision, the Ingraham v. upholding physical corporal punishment in the schools, that the standard that the court applied exceeded any standards of punishment in any of the federal penitentiaries. Moreover, it violated the Uniform Code of Justice in the military. That was Thurgood Marshall's dissenting opinion. Baker v. Owen is actually, the Supreme Court let it stand. It's an appellate court decision arguing that corporal punishment in school doesn't violate the Eighth Amendment. So, anyway, I've been involved in cases where parents were accused of physical abuse and the behavior that the parents engaged in would have been acceptable if the teacher had done it under Ingraham v. Wright. Delicious irony. I'm gonna go through a bunch of slides really fast. And that is, this morning I had a conversation with a woman. Nobody likes to think of themselves as being normal. I was talking about predicting behavior, which is what I do. And everybody likes to think of themselves as being different. That the laws of behavior don't apply to me. You know, I'm going to be a better mathematician. I'm going to be more productive post PhD. I'm going to, you know, fill in the blank. It's the Garrison Keillor, everybody being above average and so forth. On the other hand, there's certain aspects of life that we assume have a degree of typicality. So people assume that their childhood experiences are largely normal. So one of the things that happens is people bring personal experiences to a whole lot of both clinical endeavors and public opinion and decision making. So let me just show you some things. These are just three samples. I got lots of samples. This bar is based on 17,000 undergraduates from the University of Iowa, where I collected data over a decade and a half. That's a real reliable finding. 17,000 subjects over a decade and a half is a fair number of people. Anyway, these are college students. These are parents of children, about 400 of those. And these are indigent women at an antepartum clinic. So they are imminent mothers. Some of them might already be mothers, but they were there. They were imminent mothers at an antepartum clinic. So notice this, that about 55, depending on the sample, 55 to 58% describe being physically disciplined as a child. But close to 90%, a little over, report having been spanked. So it seems crazy, doesn't it? That you would think that physical discipline would be a superordinate category and spanking would be a member. But the general population sees spanking as distinguishable from other disciplinary acts. This is very reliable. The Oregon Youth Study had exactly the same findings. There's data out of just lots of data on this. Anyway, and college students, about a third, and roughly 50% of the antepartum women and the parents of kids seen at child psychiatry clinic indicate they were struck by objects in the disciplinary acts of their parents, and then right around a third report having been hit in a manner other than spanking.
When was that done?
Pardon me?
When was that done?
These data were collected between 1976 and mid-90s. So it's a, one of my papers came out and I was describing some of this stuff, and I was at a meeting in Washington, and it had just come out, and people said it was the most depressing paper they had seen, because we weren't showing any decline. We had subjects whose childhood was before mandatory reporting and before all the capital legislation, and then we had a sample whose childhood was after all the abuse legislation. And people said, oh man, you know, this is just so depressing because things aren't getting better. Anyway, so punching and choking and being beaten, but you know, even university students, 5% report being punched, about 3% report being choked. Now these are in the context of discipline. Kicking is more common than choking.
And that's by the parents.
Yeah, disciplinary acts experienced. This is the base rate of being injured because of the disciplinary acts of one's parents. Requiring medical services, and this is saying that you were abused as a child. So notice how few people say they were physically abused as a child. Yeah?
I have.
Have what?
Been abused.
Well, and people have been abused, that's right. But the question is, what are the experiences that are classified as being abusive? So that...
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
Were they like self-defining?
Yes.
What abuse?
Yes,
was?
Exactly. Which, see, that's... Like, if you say, I was abused, the question is, we need to know what your experiences were as opposed to the classification of abuse, and I'll show you why.
Well, I've been hit.
Sure. They would fit under that, but it depends on whose standard. See, you can have personal standards, you can have community standards, and you can have the standards of experts.
Well, the thing I would stand there and say to follow up my abuse was that my father was not in his right mind. He was inebriated.
Well, alcohol is an accelerator. Sure. Sure.
He was inebriated most of the time.
Sure. Alcohol is a risk factor. But anyway, let me.
How'd you get out of his way?
Murray Strauss, who's a major figure, he's the guy that developed the conflict tactics scale. So these four different groups are people who meet Murray Strauss's criteria and self-label themselves as having been abused. NSL means they did not self-label. And then these are subjects who were not abused by Murray Strauss's criteria but still said they were abused. And people who did not meet Murray Strauss's criteria. So, and it doesn't matter what sample, I just picked some for this presentation. But here's the point here. 55% of University of Iowa undergraduates would have been abused by Murray Strauss's standard. Because Murray Strauss describes abuse, he largely includes anything that is potentially injurious. So if you're struck by objects, it doesn't matter what the consequence was. It could be a fly swatter, it could be a spatula. It doesn't matter what the object is. If a parent strikes a child with an object, Murray Strauss says it's abuse. When he testified before the Armed Services Committee in Congress because of a concern about abuse on military bases, you can imagine what the Congress thought when Murray gave out his standard of abuse, because virtually all the guys in Congress and women too, that probably 55% have had those experiences, and so they say, well, I turned out great. Can't be a problem. There's a study done in Texas. It was University of Houston, in which they asked the general public to describe an event and classify it as abuse or not. And about 25% of University of Iowa undergraduates would have met a criterion for a majority of Texans. So pinching, striking with a coat hanger, hitting with a belt is not abuse, according to a majority of Texans, but hitting with a belt buckle is. Hitting with a coat hanger is abuse. Anyway, they got a whole bunch of things. But notice how few of the people actually say they were abused, even if they meet the Sapin-Carter criteria. And the same pattern holds. Anyway, this is a very conservative standard for abuse that Audrey Berger developed using a variety of the same kind of data we do. But this is the only point I want to make. About 8%, if you add these two bars together, Audrey estimates about 8% of the university undergraduates meet a criterion for having been physically abused, but only 1 in 4 would characterize their experiences as abusive. We did a study of young adults who were adjudicated maltreated. They were removed from their homes because of abuse. And only 1 out of 4 responded affirmatively to the statement, I was physically abused by one or both parents. When in fact, they were. They were in out-of-home placements and they were adjudicated. So when you say you were abused, that's an uncommon statement to make. It's just...
Well, I ended up not being fed.
Yeah, but it's a uncommon statement. Even when people have really terrible experiences, most of them will not characterize it as having been abusive. And I never estimate how long it takes for me to go through stuff. Anyway, people tend to normalize their personal experiences. So people who have been spanked are less likely to label it as abusive than people who weren't spanked. People who are hit in a manner that's not spanking are less likely to label it abusive than people who haven't had the experience. Being struck with objects. Now, if you've been injured, that changes the whole picture. The people who have been hit with objects or hit in a manner other than spanking, those are the people who label it as abusive, if they actually experience physical injury. And these are just examples of things that people have struck kids with. And shakings. Anyway, so life experiences largely determine how people. And this is a finding that I really am interested in, because these people have described their personal experiences, 1 out of 4. Characterizes their experiences as abusive. If they describe their siblings as having exactly the same experiences, so they describe their own experiences, they describe their siblings as having had the same experience, they're almost twice as likely to say their siblings were abused. And it regresses on a perception of being deserving of punishment. If people think they deserve it, then it wasn't abuse. So I've had people tell me that, you know, they were really bad kids. And a woman, I was doing a court-ordered evaluation. We were in jail. I was evaluating someone in jail. And she said to me, you gotta beat a kid's ass to make them behave. Just like that woman who said, he had to be, the same phrase. And I hear that phrase all the time. And then she said, my dad beat me. And look how good I turned out. Now, we're doing an evaluation in jail. There's something that isn't quite right? And
it's interesting that the mind will sometimes just want to block it out.
That's right.
You just want to block it out.
That's right.
How does birth order figure into this?
I don't know.
Because I would think that...
I don't know. I know that'd be a tough study to do. It's a very good question. Do that study.
I'm going into public health, though. Because I would think that an oldest sibling would be more likely to be like kind of the protector.
I don't think we've got birth order data. I know that Kelly Rausch is the person who was really behind providing the impetus. Mary Bauer is doing work on this now. She's in Michigan. And when I get back, I'll send Mary an email and say, hey, look at birth order in your data sets. Yeah.
We were able to shut down a home health care because my brother was abused, and it was both physical abuse and starvation.
Well, that's...
And it showed scars on his body and it showed wounds all over his chest because I don't know what they did, but they really got him.
Electric cords is one that's a real common one that produces scars.
Yeah.
They hit.
We like would have shut them down.
Yeah. So anyway, I tend not to ask people whether they were abused. I want to know what they actually experienced. And generally, I haven't even gotten to neglect, and I got stopped. I never know where I'm going. It's not clear. Actually, neglect is more important because it's more common. But anyway, I believe that we need to think in terms of discipline resulting in serious injury or persistent bruising. You know, red marks and that probably isn't sufficient for the standard. But the kind of thing you're talking about would. Striking with some objects and then blows about the head and neck because that's thought to be high risk for head injuries, subdural hematomas, that aren't necessarily going to show up.
I've had ear injury because I can't hear it.
That's a common one, and that would be blows to the head. We're always asking people if they were ever unconscious. Of course, you know, playing football will do that to you too. But
or you could die in that too.
Yeah, but I mean, the base rate of undergraduate males having had concussions is like 25% of undergraduate males will report a head injury with a concussion. And brief loss of consciousness. You know, like the sports announcers always, my wife used to work in a head injury clinic. So you know, when some sports announcer says, oh, he just had his bell rung, you know, she's screaming, you know, there's brain damage there, it's a head injury, you know, it's not trivial. So anyway, physical restraint and also shaken baby syndrome. So that's the interagency task force set of criteria I have here. Oh, and then I was arguing we shouldn't have subcultural exclusions. So this is it.
Yeah, different societies have, of course, different races have different ways of dealing with.
But the evidence is not clear. We believe it to be the case. One of the things that my research in northern Wisconsin, I tried to get collaboration with some of the tribal entities. Mm-hmm. And they've argued that the tribal structure protects the kids from adverse influences, but it doesn't necessarily. Mm-hmm. See, and I can understand why the tribes might not want me hanging around. I can understand that.
You're a white person.
That's right, and I that's fine. I think that's okay. I don't have a problem with that at all. But I sure wish I could be more effective in getting them to think about how we measure. You know, because some tribes, it's not a problem. But some tribes are able to set up their own social service agencies, and they have their own healthcare delivery structure because of their sovereignty. So we've got three tribes close by to where I'm doing the search, and one of the two uses social services from the county and everything else, and can recruit those kids and those families pretty easily. It's quite hard to deal with the Forest County Potawatomi.
We have a Seattle Indian Health Board in our area, well, where I'm living in Seattle. So
yeah.
Seattle Indian Health Board, it has all the different facets.
Are you Seattle? Is that your tribe?
Yeah. Well, I'm Skokomish, but all of the Native people around the greater Seattle area, we have our Seattle Indian Health Board that has the ability to take care of all different kind of cases.
Yeah. And I would like to, not Seattle, I can't handle. I've got no problems with Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin, but the ability to work with various tribal entities that provide healthcare services is a great resource for doing research.
Native working with Native.
Yeah.
So that makes it,
yeah.
We feel better.
But we should be able to work out a way to collaborate.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I don't offend people.
Yeah, true.
I try my best. So, anyway, I better stop here. I'm not supposed to run over. So I didn't get to neglect, but
yeah, so what?
So what? But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are you doing more sessions on this general subject?
Yeah, I won't go back to this. I'll probably allude to some neglect things. Tomorrow is, I think it's risk factors and epidemiology of abuse and neglect, both socioeconomic factors and parent factors and kid factors that contribute. And then I think Wednesday I do a thing on measuring harsh discipline and neglect. I've got a three-state, one of my projects is a three-state study with multi-site study. And we directly measure families, and I've been arguing that we shouldn't use administrative data, so I'll talk about how I measure neglect and abuse. And then I've got a session on abuse and neglect and how that leads to antisocial aggressive behavior in young children, 4 to 8. That's my Thursday, I think. And then Friday, I'm doing child custody and nasty divorces. I live on the seamy side of life. Like you do, right?
Yes, I sure do.
Huh?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yeah, but that's okay. Somebody has to do it. What do you do?
I'm a lawyer, but I don't practice in this field. I'm just,
oh, yeah.
I don't practice in the field.
Well, and that's probably just as well, in a way. I mean, I think people who practice in this area really need to specialize in it. My wife and I used to joke that if we were to get divorced, when the kids were young, it was going to be a foot race to Sharon Mellon's office, because she is so good. That's what she does. She's one of the best guardian ad litem I've ever worked with. She's really good at it. And I remember one time we were in this really awful case, and she was representing the mother at the time, and the guardian ad litem was really not doing a good job. And I made the comment that this woman was not a particularly good lawyer, and Sharon got all over me with both feet and said, she's a great lawyer if you're doing contracts. But her firm rotates people through to do pro bono guardian ad litem work, and she was so unsettled by these families and these experiences. She was trying to do the job. But she was ill-prepared to do the job. And my son's an attorney, but he's not practicing law. And he doesn't want to, he wants to do environmental law, he wants to do native rights, native conflict with the states. He's not going to do it because the tribes don't want to hire white lawyers. Mm-hmm. He did have a job offer from a tribe, but it was a weird job. But anyway, he doesn't want to, he's done guardian ad litem work, he doesn't want to do it. You know, his old man can mess around with this stuff, but he doesn't want to mess around, right? So, you know, it's just, it's interesting.
Who do you work for?
I just changed jobs, actually. I worked for the Gathering Place in Denver.
Yeah.
I worked at the Gathering Place for parent care. You know what that is? The daytime shelter?
Yes, for women and playing
Well, some of them are.
Well,
the wide majority are mentally ill or addicted to drugs or both.
Okay.
And I just started last week with the Jeffco Action Center.
Huh?
In their development department. It's very heavy of burnout, and I usually change jobs.
So what are you doing with the Action Center?
Writing grants, special events, children relations.
So you're mostly working with people with disabilities, then?
No, my development, like, money, raising money.
Oh, well, that's important to me.
I just needed to get out of the direct care aspect of things. So.
I don't provide services. You know, I'm a clinical psychologist, but But I don't, I do once in a while, but mostly what I do is the services I provide is in custody disputes, we do evaluations and then we testify in court. You might really enjoy my thing on Friday if you're around.
I'm actually going to be around. That sounds interesting.
Because that's one of the big battles, of course, is whether or not experts are violating all our rules of jurisprudence, you know. So you have people inserting themselves as triers of fact when they don't belong there,
right.
i.e. psychologists.
Right.
But then you have jurists who want them to do it because they get these awful families and they don't know what to do, and the statutes aren't necessarily clear, and the best interests of the child guidelines aren't clearly delineated, and so they need somebody to help them.
Now, this is a tough area for judges. That's one reason. In Colorado, I'm the chairman of a group called the Colorado Judicial Institute, which is an organization that tries to support judges and maintain independence of judges and provide educational resources for them. And this is a tough area.
It's tough.
A lot of them are doing something totally different, and suddenly they get thrown into these cases.
I had one where it was in probate court, and you want a judge that's ill-prepared, and what happened is, this guy killed his girlfriend and committed suicide in the presence of his kid, these two toddlers. And, of course, they died intestate. So the disposition of child care goes to probate court. So it doesn't go to all the usual avenues of a child custody dispute. So you had the paternal grandparents, the maternal grandmother and step-grandfather, the maternal grandfather and step-grandmother, and a maternal aunt and uncle, four couples in a knockdown, drag-out battle over who provides care for these twin toddlers. And it's in probate court. And the guardian ad litem got me involved, and we evaluated all the parties, and it was very complicated. It was really complicated. And they ultimately did what I had recommended, and I think that was okay. I mean, they hammered out a stipulation. I don't think I inserted myself unreasonably in the case. But there have been other cases where, you know, I make these recommendations and this judge walking down the street sees me and says, "John, you didn't do me any favors on that one, you know." You didn't give me clear direction. I said, "Well, there's no basis to give you clear direction. You
got to do your best.
You got to do." We
had Colorado just had a case decided a few months ago where Colorado is one of the few states that has common law marriage for reasons that are sort of crazy. Court held that there's no statutory minimum age of consent for women does not apply to common law marriage. And so then they went back to what it was in England in the 1300s, and it was 12, age of 12.
Sure.
So, you know, of course I got everybody. And I think they actually changed that statute already.
Well, I'm sure, but I mean, we're at the mercy of what's available. I mean, that's,
yeah. So
that was like that poor judge got hammered.
Right.
Oh, they want a recall. I mean, this guy was
absolutely
just hammered, and he did what was right. The fact that we have prosecutors, I've got long lists of cases where people don't understand, can't distinguish one sexual act from another one, and so they get prosecutorial a mess.
Right, they have to do what the law is.
That's right.
And that case was decided on a loophole, wasn't it? Like some obscure little...
Well, it was
it's not a loophole.
I think it was the fault of the legislature for never adopting a statute that said you can't have common law marriage, or if you're going to have common law marriage, here's the rules and regulations.
Yeah.
So this girl, I think she's like 14 or 15.
Yeah, but by now she's 16 or something. And she was like 14 or 15 when she got common law married, but it was a guy who was 38. It was probably
was abuse.
An abusive situation.
That's right. But see, if she's 14, and if Colorado is a 5-year differential state, then the guy would have to be 19, which he is. But if you got the 5-year differential, But some states eliminate the 5-year differential at 14. See, and then you would have issues of consent.
For statutory merit, they do have that kind of, those kinds of issues. But see, it didn't apply to common law marriage, because that's just, you live together and hold yourself out as a married couple, and you're married, just as if you'd gone down to the higher.
I have a family that, because I recruit these families in Wisconsin, my IRAs called me and they said, well, I think we got a problem. The mother, I think, is 27. The guy that's living with, and we try and recruit partners in this research, the guy is 17. So he's under the age of majority, can't sign informed consent to engage in research. His parents have to sign for him. So I said, well, is he living now? Is he married to her? Is he living with her? Is he emancipated? Turns out he's not. He's living part-time with his parents and part-time with his 27-year-old guy. I know it's weird, but he's not quote emancipated. See, I can't enroll him in research. So we had to say, look,
come back.
And she wanted, that's right. And she wanted to enroll because we pay our subject $50 every time they come in. So that he would have gotten paid a couple $100. And we couldn't enroll him, and we didn't think that made any sense to go get his parents' permission to enroll him. And you know, other things bizarre. But and you might have said, well, what's this 27-year-old woman doing hanging around with a 17-year-old kid? That's bad judgment right there. But
do they have children?
She had children, not with him. She has got several kids, yeah. Each with a different father.
Right.
And I'm sure she's going to have a kid with this guy, too. You know, it's just a matter of the timing wasn't right. So.
Well, the law has its limitations. In it, you know. There's only so much the law can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Unfortunately, children. There's so many situations that you don't find out about until it's too late.
Yeah. And again, there's things that you just, the legislature can't imagine happening. You know, I mean, they can't, you know, you could say, well, they've been derelict, but to some extent, they're at the mercy of information, too.
Right.
And,
no, that's true.
And, you know, the Congress, when they reauthorized CAPTA, they weren't going to reauthorize it. It was under welfare reform. Conservative Congress wasn't going to, they didn't want intrusion into the family. And then somebody said, well, you know what you're doing? You're eliminating the missing children hotline. Well, what congressman can vote against the missing children hotline?
So, right.
So we throw a few million dollars a year, which in the big picture of the federal government's not much money, but it's largely wasted. Because the missing children are abducted by non-custodial parents in the circumstance of divorce.
Right.
Everybody can remember Johnny Walsh, they can remember, I mean, the base rates are so low, you can remember all these cases. I mean, I can go back to my childhood and remember these celebrated cases.
Right.
You know, but they're rare. But anyway, so what happened is they salvaged CAPTA because of the missing children hotline. Because who could vote against it? Well,
regardless of how useful.
Yeah. So we got something out of a bad idea. You know, that's the same thing with satanic risk of Halloween and
public policy is made.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, absolutely. But it's not the attorney's fault, even though they get blamed for it.